window? What does a man do when it's all over? What does it matter what he does? Why shouldn't he do it? Death was coming. Life was over. Harry walked to his back porch and unhooked the screen door. The girl skated back down the driveway. As she neared the screen door, Harry leaped out and grabbed her. He had his hand across her mouth and the other hand about her waist. The girl was clumsy on her skates. Harry dragged her in through the screen door, across the back porch, through the kitchen, and into the front room. Then he held her there as she wiggled. She yanked her head about and almost stumbled down a few times. Harry held her in the center of the room. For a moment, he thought, God Almighty, what have I done? How can I get out of this? Can I let her go and tell her I'm sorry and not to tell anybody about it? No, it's too late. It's too late for that. He held her for some minutes like that. He held her for some minutes like that, held hand across her mouth as she struggled. Those brown eyes, now remember, this is because he's an inaugural attempt to be a columnist in a local paper. He held her for some minutes like that, hand across her mouth as she struggled. Those brown eyes looked into his, fearful and wild. She wobbled and kicked on her skates. She was like a drunken woman in immense high heels. He released his hand, and his mouth was upon hers. She had long brown hair. It swayed backwards and whirled. He felt his large mouth upon her small one. He felt his large mouth upon her small one. He felt like an animal of prey. There was hardly time for thought. He was heated and mad. Never anything so good. I don't give a damn. I don't give a damn. I don't give a damn. His hand was against her panties. His hand was against her panties, and he worked them down. And then with the same hand, he worked at his zipper. He got his penis out and began poking. She's on her roller skates. She's on her roller skates. She's on her roller skates. A virgin's cherry? Could he get it in? He had the head in, and he bumped the head back and forth. He looked at the terror in her eyes and her long, dark hair, and he bumped harder. More of him slipped in. Then, like a finger that finds itself in the proper hole in the glove, he slipped in suddenly. He didn't feel a blood wetness. He took his mouth away and looked at her. The child was transfixed. She was on the cross. She was on the cross of his cock. He pulled it back, then rammed it forward. She gasped and let out a small scream. He began to pump like the insane creature he was. He jostled her about the room on her skates. As he climaxed, he leaned forward and joined his large mouth to her small one. Dot, dot, dot. Then says, Harry sat on the couch, drinking and watching her on the rug. Then he got up and took off her roller skates. A few minutes later, she got up and walked out of the front room to the kitchen and out the back porch door. Harry sat looking at the roller skates. He picked up the phone and asked the operator to give him the police station. Quote, listen, I want to report a rape of a child. All right, sir, where? Harry gave the address. Then he says, I'm the rapist. I don't deserve to live. The police say, have you been drinking, buddy? Of course, but the facts are true. Harry hung up. He walked to the kitchen and poured a big one. Then he came back to the couch and sat down, drank half the drink, and lit a cigar. So this was how it happened. Well, in a sense, it was like committing suicide. They'd take him out of society, yet he didn't feel good about it. It hadn't been a particularly brave act. The phone rang. Harry? Yeah? This is Diane. Diane? Oh, Diane? How you doing, Diane? Diane says, you seem cheered up somehow. Harry says, I guess so. She says, listen, Harry, maybe I've been a little rough on you. Harry says, what? She says, I mean, maybe I've been a little too cruel. Harry hung up. In a moment, the phone rang again. Harry lifted the receiver, put it down again, then lifted it again and let it hang from the cord. Diane listened to the sound. Zzz, 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 zzz. How's that for an opening story? We'll probably, all of you are going to get arrested later today for listening to this. What a fantastic ending.
Bob, was Larry Flint connected to these guys?
Wait, now a little louder. What'd you say?
Was Larry Flint connected to these guys in any way?
He, in 1978, he bought the L.A. Like, he was just starting out in the early 70s, wow. You know, and Chicago or someplace. He probably had the mafia going. So he built up his empire through the 70s, same time as Goldstein was doing Screw. And so by 78, he had a lot of money. So he bought the L.A. Free Press, and he made a very special issue dedicated to exposing who killed Kennedy. And it was a pretty good issue. It had a lot of new information in it. And so shortly after, he was shot. Someone tried to kill him for doing that. And that's when he got paralyzed. And he was paralyzed for 5 years in total agony. And then he had had some kind of operation in 83 where he had his sex organs disconnected so that he couldn't have sex or whatever it meant, and but he wouldn't be in pain anymore. So now he had energy. He wasn't distracted by pain. So that's when he started the Rebel magazine in November 83 with May Brussel as editor. And that was Larry's revolution. And in that period, he had put out a big ad saying he didn't believe the KAL-007 shoot down by Russia. He said that was done by the Americans or something. And Larry McDonald, JW's congressman, was on that plane, and he died in 83. So Zappa was in the office in September 83, and he saw the ad that Larry was making, big ad saying he didn't believe in the KAL-007. And Frank said, well, you need to write this and change that. So he helped improve the ad. So then Larry got to know Frank a little bit there. And so he said, I'm going to do a special on you. So in April 84, there's a big Zappa issue comes out with a lot of pictures and stuff around his off-Broadway play, Thingfish, images from that that he proposed, which never happened on off-Broadway. But the album came out. So that's in April 84. Meanwhile, there's been about 8 issues of The Rebel, and May is booted off by some lefty, established lefty guy, Mark Cooper, who didn't like May. So they sanitized The Rebel a little bit, though May got some of her articles in. And Larry, meanwhile, was going crazier because Tim Leary and Dick Gregory and other and the guy in the Spooks book, forget his name, he was a CIA guy who invented silencers. They were hanging around Larry at his mansion feeding him some weird drugs. So, I don't know, sometime in, let's say, January 84, he's in Chicago to do some speaking, but he gets dragged into court, and May tells Skolnick, who lived in Chicago, to go fucking meet Larry. Now, Skolnick was in a wheelchair. Larry was in a wheelchair, so Skolnick told the story later. He's sitting in front of the judge, he and Larry, wheelchair to wheelchair, and Larry is dressed in a diaper designed like the American flag, and he's causing, you know, outrageous stuff. And Skolnick's wondering what the fuck's going on. He's not totally familiar with Larry Flint. He tells all this to May, you know, probably the next day, but Larry gets put away in an insane asylum. I think it's Rochester, some clinic somewhere, and that's the end of Flint for a year or so. And you notice in Hustler magazine, they become less political throughout 84. The editorials are all, you know, blanded out. But there's Zappa in the April 84 issue while Larry's in mental prison. And I think where he was is where they sent LaRouche eventually. It's a famous, what they call a mind control hospital, specialized in MK Ultra stuff. So now I'm telling you, so that's Larry Flint. And so he owned the LA Free Press, and I don't know how long he owned it. You know, he got shot for what he did in 78. And then I don't know what happened to the paper after that. Maybe if you look it up, probably faded out and disappeared. So, but back to this thing I just read you. So the editor, owner of the LA Free Press in March 1972, Art Kunkin, who did an excellent Zappa interview in August 69, which I've always quoted, he says this. When Bukowski brought this, Bukowski was well known in LA. When Bukowski brought this article into the Free Press, he said to me, quote, "This may be too vile for the Free Press. If you don't want to use it, you don't have to." And then Art Kunkin says, and when I sat down to read the next day, I began to think very seriously of calling him up and asking if he had a substitute column. Then I began to think, the article isn't obscene. Now, that's not true today, right? The article isn't obscene, but it just shows you what was going on back then, the free spirit. The article isn't obscene. It just deals with a very taboo subject. But it deals with this subject in a serious and well-written exploration of the pain which a human being inflicts upon himself, not at all in a sensational manner. So I said to myself, quote, okay, I'm seeing it this way and have an editorial interest in the public seeing it, but what will the reader think? Well, I don't know how the reader thinks unless I give him/her the opportunity to think by printing Bykowski's, and he has in quotes, vileness. By printing Bykowski's vileness. Remember, Bykowski said it might be too vile. So here it is, he says to the audience, or readers. And both Bykowski and I would welcome you. If you read Bykowski before, you know he really does love little children in an entirely proper way. And these aren't just words because I've seen, his tenderness with his own child. Maybe he wrote this purely because
one
he
loser
is
of all
father.
The winners. It'll be great.
So that is the opening column.
Thank you very much.
And Bykowski goes on, writes that fucking column for many years, 600 and something stories. And he becomes really famous, and then he goes to Europe and he tours. But he got away with this opening article. So I think that's an amazing historical point. Right? This is history that you're not even allowed to remember.
And that was his first article out of the 600?
So I found out about him about 1975, 74, 75, at the Halifax Art College Library, which was the hippest library. And there's a book out I have called The Last Art College. It's really good because everybody who became famous went there because they were quite different as an art college. They're more free, and Dennis Young was their main eminence grise intellectual, who I bought his library a couple years ago. So I would go down the library and get that week's L.A. Free Press. I read it religiously from 74 to 77, till before we went to Toronto. And I was often seen falling on the floor laughing my ass off at this fucking guy's stuff. And all the students are there studying their art history of that. And I'm reading real art history right there in front of them, falling on the floor. So the guy, the student who ran the library, he got to know me because I showed up regularly and was reading the dirty underground magazine. He later introduced me to somebody, said, here's Bob, he's a free spirit. So I thought that was interesting. I was considered a free spirit. That was my category in Halifax. So what a marvelous story I just told you. And Chad gets the credit for finding all this stuff.
Yeah.
Or excavating
good
it.
Good find.
A good what? Good find,
good
right?
Good find, yeah. Good find. I mean, had no
idea.
So
I'm going to send this to Ed. And let's not say anything. Here's your next thing to post. We'll see if you read this. What the fuck, Bob? We can't post this.
Then you'll know if he's really reading what you're sending him to post.
That's right. Yeah, we're going to find out all about Ed. But, you know, we're allowed to do it on our own site, right? Can't police our site.
He would know. I don't know. I mean,
but I think it's quite public. I think it goes out there on Google or something. So.
Yes, it goes on Google.
So we'll find out. We'll see if any of you guys get arrested. They ain't going to arrest me, but they might arrest you, fucker.
Distributing child pornography, yeah.
Yeah.
Child pornography in words.
Wow.
But you see, it's really well written.
Yeah.
You know, it flows real nicely as a story.
I saw a video with Bykowski he was criticizing American romantic writers like Faulkner and how they just go on too long trying to set up a scene, and by the time they reach their emotional climax, there isn't one. He said, Bykowski said, when he writes, it should just be like, ba, ba, ba. bop, 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 like just short, punchy statements. And I can see him doing that here. And the rhythm of it, it kind of gives it that dirtiness.
Yeah. No, he was a different kind of writer. And so I met Ginsberg in Halifax in 76. He came to speak at Dalhousie and was talking to him at the party after. And I brought up Bukowski, and he didn't want to talk about him. You know, in Ginsberg, all these guys are known to be free, open-minded guys, or supposedly, but he, and then the other guy, Robert somebody, another famous poet, he wouldn't talk about him. I said, this guy's cool, man. He gets his articles out there every week. The people get to see his poetry or his prose poetry. They weren't impressed. So he eventually, he becomes really big in the 80s, more popular than Ginsberg and those guys. He actually gets his day in the sun. But there was another thing that happened. When I went and met him in 76, Worcester drives me over. He's sitting outside, and I go up and knock on the door. Carolyn's in the car with Worcester, and Bukowski comes to the door, and it's kind of the afternoon, and it's sort of dark, and it's like lion head is looking at me. And not a very friendly-looking guy. And I said, hey, Charles, wonder if you want to party. He says to me, I don't party. Who are you? So I said who I was, and he said, no, not today. So I left. So then I went back. What happened? So then in 77, we go to Toronto. We end up living in Hamilton at McMaster University, which I think I mentioned tonight. Ian mentioned McMaster just out of the blue. It's the first time I ever did that. So I got Bukowski's phone number. So I started calling him, and he would regularly answer. So he would talk. He's very friendly over the phone. But while you talk to him, Casey would say, there's nothing like sticking your dick into a new pussy. He celebrates sticking his dick in. He's fucking everybody. He had a lot of groupies. So so I learned a lot about him. And I learned that he wasn't at all the character. This hairy guy, you know, is a pervert guy. He's partying all the time, just fucking anything that moves. That's not the way Bukowski was. He talked a good line, but he had a girlfriend. He had steady girlfriends or something. And so in 1980, I went back there, and I went and knocked on the door, and nobody answered. And then I walked out into the little driveway, exactly what he's been describing in this article. And some guy at the end, up on a balcony, says, hey. I go, yeah. Are you looking for Bukowski? And I said, yep. He said, well, he's not here right now, but come on over. So I went into his apartment. We sat there for a couple of hours, and this guy was really smart, and we talked all about everything, including McLuhan. He knew about McLuhan. So I had this incredible discussion with this you know, smart guy who was living in Bohemia sort of thing and being the house watcher of Bukowski. So so I didn't see Bukowski that day. So then I went back to Toronto, and I called Bukowski, you know, a few weeks later, and we got talking, and then I hear him say, hey, Paul, or some name. Hey, Paul, no, I'll be over there in 5 minutes. So I said, is that Paul who lives at the end of the driveway, the back house? And he says, yeah. I said, yeah, I met him when I came by your place in 1980. He's a good guy. So we talked a bit about him. So that's my story with Bukowski. I never got to be with him in person because he didn't party. And, of course, I never partied. So it was two people who don't party trying to meet and didn't meet because we didn't party. But we could do a lot of stuff on the phone. So that's
maybe he thought you were gay, because I think gay guys say that a lot from the other guys.
Yeah, you want a party? Yeah. Oh yeah. So then I have the a biography came out many years later. I have it in the library, and it's written by this guy who knew Bukowski really well, and he said Bukowski got all his sexy, perverted stories from two young people who lived near him, maybe even in that little compound, who were in the porn industry in the 70s. That's real early. And they would tell about all their stories and crazy people they had to fuck or something for their shows, for their, videos? I guess they did video. And that's where he got all his material from, this young couple. So, very cagey guy. Notes of a Dirty Old Man, his column was called. Imagine even doing that in any other newspaper in the world. Notes of a Dirty Old Man.
Yeah, first edition raping a young girl.
An 8-year-old.
Yeah, tough act to follow.
Yeah, and it has a title, his name, and then it has a picture of a roller skate. That's the only photo. The only picture is a roller skate.
It's like clip art of a roller skate.
Yeah.
But Bert, when you start to go through the East Village Other, if you're starting at the beginning, I don't think there's like any nudity in the beginning, but by the time you get to 1972, there's more nudity in the book than there are like articles.
Well,
that's right.
I remember Bob read. I heard it on Office Hours about someone sent a love letter, some lady love letter, and come to find out it was the guy trying to lure.
It was Stephen Heller. It was the letter before Jameson's letter.
Yes.
And in October 22nd, 69 issue, if you want to look it up. And it's all posted on Ina Bob. Right there,
yes.
You can see all these things. And this guy, the letter is from a young woman who totally loves Dean Latimer's column and wants to fuck him. And she does this very detailed description of what she's going to do to his dick when she gets near him. So it goes on for a long time. And then they have Dean responds, editor's response to the letter. He says, okay, Steve, I get your message. I'll have the manuscript ready for you by Thursday. He knows Steve pretending he's some groupie writing a letter. And so the other day I was looking so then Chad finds this article, or we both find the article, about the New York Review of Sex and Politics, and it's this Steve guy, and his name's Steve Heller, and he's 19 years old starting the sex newspaper. So he's the guy that Dean started to write for Screw and Kiss and the New York Review of Sex and Politics, because the EVO was fading out and no money in it. So I'm standing there a few days later, just a week ago, and I'm looking at my library, and there I see Steve Heller, and I pull this book out. Holy shit, I got this book about a year ago. It was fantastic. It's his life in the underground press of New York City, and he's got pictures of the covers and articles and Dean Latimer and everybody, and I bought it because it was so good archive of everything. So I have this Steve guy that Dean saying, yeah, I'll have the article for you by Thursday. I have his own story. And so when I bought it, I found his Facebook page and asked him, hey, do you know where Dean Latimer is? But he never responded. He went on to write for the New York Times and become an established writer in New York. All these guys, they all started in the basement, and they all become somebody in the New York media. And I guess so he's too much of a snob to respond to Mr. Dobbs. So we'll see.
The reason why I mentioned Larry Flint is I remember looking through Hustler magazine many, many moons ago, and he always had a cartoon called Chester the Molester, which was disgusting. Cartoon. Yeah. It
Chester
was cartoon, just like what you just described.
Yeah. Well, what happened is that when Reagan came in, Ed Meese was his attorney general or something. And I remember May talking about it, said this is part of the fascism of Reagan, is that they really started to bust all the porn magazines. And that led to, Jerry Falwell went after Larry Flint. Larry Flint had to go to court. They made a movie about it. I remember Larry Flint's wife is played by Coco Love, Courtney Love. She
yes.
plays Larry's wife. So all this fundamentalist repression of stuff started in the Reagan era. And then I guess everybody moved to the Internet in the 90s, and you could do a lot on the Internet. And then now the Internet's censored, or YouTube and Web 2.0. But the world of the 60s in the media is where the revolution took place of expression, of, you know, free no limits.
Yeah.
Young people would be surprised to see what was done then, back then.
I don't think surprise is an adequate word to describe what they would feel, but something.
Yeah,
like
they
that.
Would think. Well, they'd say, "Wow, those guys were cavemen. They did need to be censored. Look how macho or rude they were. What's the word? Perverted?
Toxic masculinity."
Yeah, how toxic they were back then. So we're going to retrieve these guys.
What's really special about the EVO is just how subgenius it all is and how it mixes together. I'm guessing, because I wasn't alive then, I wasn't reading magazines, but it seems even unique in all the things that I've glossed over, that you have a juxtaposition between all these different, like you've got a serious like theater column, theater review, theater and film with
yeah.
Rita Lescu. Then you've got the writers who consistently write about strikes and protests and like what kind of frictions there are in society. And then you've got the like spiritual hippie writers, and then you got the like just got a mix of everything together
yeah.
in there, rubbing up against each other. And then you've got those crazy comic strips that explore the dark subconscious of humanity, like the incest
yeah.
comic strip. And
so what Chad said is that his whole which I didn't know he had this effect, but he said his imagery of the 60s has been totally destroyed. Now that would be the reason you talk to Bob. As you get these images in your head of what you think reality was, usually it's media landscapes. And so Chad, he's got his head cleaned up, man. He doesn't
mm-hmm.
have those stupid images he got when he was a kid about
yeah.
the 60s.
You do clean up history. You've cleaned history a lot
yeah.
for me as well.
Yeah.
You get the backstories that you never knew or never heard, and then you find these articles. It would be fun for me to go and read this, look at these.
Yeah.
Real fun.
And the
Bob, you made a point too.
Let me just say this, Jed.
Yeah.
I just add this: the image, a great image cleanup is the present Mark and Eric doing the Kennedy assassination characters. That's incredible.
Yes.
Series. Got to promote that. Yeah, what were we gonna say, Chad?
Yeah, when we talked about the cleaning up of the '60s, you mentioned something like that's part of ascension, because
yeah.
a lot of people, their idea of what ascension would be or what non-physical or spirit or transcendence would be was formed with these corporate images from the 60s that then again got retrieved. For example, like Oliver Stone's movie The Doors, I guess that came out in the early 90s
yeah.
or something. That would have been
yeah.
a good example of the holopathic retrieval that brought the Gen
yeah.
X's into that false version of transcendence.
Yeah. And celebrating a guy committed suicide.
Yeah.
You know, and there was, maybe he didn't. Maybe he disappeared. We don't know what happened to him. But the big tragedy, I saw Mark Salman doing a video the other day, and he says, McLuhan's life was a tragedy. It's fucking bullshit that he was saying. And, people like Dean Latimer and Lee Lesio, they went on, they slog through, you know. They didn't die. They even went homeless every now and then. But they stayed on their mission. I remember Dean Latimer telling me that he wasn't going to stop. He was an editor at High Times until they legalized marijuana. And they fucking got there, for fuck's sake. For other perverse reasons. But they got his goal. It stopped the busting of his buddies. So the imagery, so people think of ascension, they think of, well, you know, if I could live like Jim Morrison, you know, I'd be ascended. And as Chad said, Dean Latimer and Leader are saying, that's bullshit, these guys. We like the people who aren't trying to be media whores or something. So that's the image you got to get cleared up. And I'm the historian of all that, the only guy still alive. I'm the only guy who met everybody, for fuck's sake, and tell you the stories.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, you're the only reason we would know about these columns and these.
Yeah, you wouldn't even know these archives exist.
Yeah, so. That's true.
I've got all the East Village Other. I bought them in the 70s. I bought microfilm. They offered it on microfilm. But I never did any with it because you'd have to take the microfiche to the library, you know, use their machine. So I never looked at it. And here it is 50 years later. It's right there in archive.org.
That's so appropriate what you just described in the last 2 minutes when you were saying earlier in the tailgate that you Bob Dobstown was a one-man army, but you just had this, like, sixth sense ESP to look out all of these obscure poets and journalists and things, and now here you are just replaying them, and it's blowing people's minds like Chad and I just to know about this stuff. It's pretty wild.
And then they phone up Dean's brothers and sisters and find out that in their genealogy, a major name is Dobbs, see? So there it gets even weirder. It's my hologram. I created the ladder on some to a level.
Wow.
So it's not a star seed. It's not a star seed like Jenny was talking about. It's a Bob seed.
Yeah, yeah. And here's an amazing thing. He was an expert on marijuana. He's the guy who told me and Carolyn that you can be, if you're a balanced person, you can do heroin and not get addicted. So he did that. And but he had never seen the making of marijuana when you make it and then you filter it or something and then you make it into a package. Whatever you do to process the marijuana plant, he'd never seen it. But here's Carolyn at her lab in New York, in the richest part of New York, on East 65th Street, has a lab where she's doing the filtering. So when Dean found out that she could do that, he begged that he come over and see it. So here's Carolyn showing the beer process, the only person who really was interested in it, and he had a professional interest because he wrote a book in 1980 with this other guy to counter LaRouche's book, Dope Inc. Wow. They're both called Flowers in the Blood. It's really good history of the cocaine business without the LaRouche angle. So here's his dope expert, High Times guy. He comes to Carolyn's lab, and he's really appreciative of finally seeing what the filtering process looks like. And he gets it from little perfect Carolyn, the little angel.
Nice.
Who never had one porno shot of herself ever. That we know of. Anyways, the... where they were allowed to talk about.
Born.
Yeah, but it was so amazing that I was sitting there watching. This is the legend. Now, these people I find are legends in their nano communities, in their subcultures, right?
Yes.
They are
right.
Famous.
Yes.
And this famous guy, hadn't seen him in 20 years, 76 to 96. He's sitting there just really appreciating what Carolyn was showing him. So she, as usual, Carol's the queen of the underground. She shows the underground marijuana dope department how it's done. It's pretty significant. But, of course, she would never have done that without me. I'm the one who knew that shit. She read these for each other, but it never fazed her much, you know.
So the angels and the aliens gave her the thumbs up.
Yeah. And then we went out to have a drink someplace and down the village. And that's when he told us about probably his biggest secret, that he's a junkie, but a conscious junkie, which I had never heard of before.
Functional.
No, you've never heard that. No one talks about people who can successfully do heroin if they're mentally strong and don't, you know, neurotically need it.
Yeah. It's rare. Very rare. I've never heard of that.
You never know. Next, we're going to hear someone being a functional fentanyl addict.
Shit.
It might be some Gen Z kid like 20 years from now.
Some politician in Congress.
You can redo Bob's life and you will go interview him and tell your grandkids about it. Here's a guy who was a conscious fentanyl user.
Oh, I don't believe in coffee. You know, I believe in this product called Remag. I don't know. It keeps me awake, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So there's really good articles in the EBO that Dean does, that Lee Dalescu does. I was looking for this one column. I knew she was right in the center of the intellectual ferment that John Brockman talks about. Did you listen to the Brockman recording, Bert?
No, I have that pressed by to look. I'm going to do it in the next week.
Yeah, for about 15 minutes, he gives the history of the guys around him and Gerd Stern who created the McLuhan fad in New York City, more than Tom Wolfe did.
Mm.
He lays out how they would meet, how it happened. And then they end up doing Head, the movie, the Monkees movie, Head in 68. So I looked up anything on it, and I found an interview with Jack Nicholson, who wrote the script for Head, which is a cult movie now. It wasn't that great in 68. Nobody was interested in the Monkees. But in retrospect, the guys who made it, they went on to make Easy Rider. Jack Nicholson says that Head, he wrote the script based on the theories of Marshall McLuhan.
Wow.
That's what he says in the interview. 1985. So that was what Gerd triggered that. And then Mary McLuhan told me, that'd be right around in 85. She was visiting David Greenberg in Los Angeles. He had a mansion that a lot of the stars came to because he was a hip artist kind of guy who helped create museum projects. And Mary said that Warren Beatty and Nicholson would come to the house after they had gone to the beach and were reading Understanding Media. And so that's in 85. And he's saying in 85 that Head's based on the theories of Marshall McLuhan. It's probably bullshit, but he was reading McLuhan and realized how important it was to read McLuhan, so he had to stick it in his own biography. Oh, yeah, I read McLuhan, you know, back there and when we did Head. Now, I know that he knew about McLuhan by 71 or so, because I remember reading an article where he was talking about the cliché, how he learned about the cliché from McLuhan. And in this particular one in 1985, he talks about the hybridization of media. That's what he learned and how it applied to acting. And, you know, the first time we were on the radio, me, Nelson, and James Kidney imitated Jack Nicholson. You're going to hear that on the timeline, October 1st, 1984. So I heard a lot about Jack Nicholson. Now, I just wrote a statement the other day. Maybe you saw it on Explorations, Fake Explorations, where I said McLuhan was the greatest actor of his day, and I was so much McLuhan, I am now the greatest actor today. And so then, well, the very week I'm writing that, I then see an interview with, quote, the greatest actor of his generation, Jack Nicholson, saying that he based it on the theories of Marshall McLuhan, for fuck's sake, which I'm the expert of, so that proves I'm a greater actor. I know McLuhan more than he does, and he keeps bumping into my life through Mary McLuhan and Gerd Stern and all that. So everybody's hovering around me. Everybody's orbiting around this invisible sun. So this is meant to inspire you people to start talking about something interesting.
So who's the biggest planet within your solar system?
Well, it'd be Carolyn.
Nice.
It's always Carolyn. And everybody else would be in second place. Because I treat everybody equally. So this Mark guy, he finds this fucking tweet where this guy is going out about me on McLuhan's birthday.
Yeah, that was great.
And the other remarks are funny. Some of them get it all mixed up. They think I'm the Church of the Subgenius. So, yeah, I heard about that Bob guy, you know. Then others say, no, I heard this Bob guy, and I got all fucked up trying to figure him out, you know. Because he's mixing me up with the Church of the Subgenius. So the whole weird effect of, I used to say there were three images of me out there after the book and all that, the Fatty Communion book and the album. And I knew it would screw up people's minds trying to figure it out. Well, this column shows up the other day, in McLuhan's birthday, well, yesterday, and expresses it. If you read the replies, did you go through that, Chad? Read all the different responses?
No, I haven't.
So guess, did I tell you? Yeah, I did say that. Guess who's in the middle of it, trying to put a stop to it, trying to control it? McLuhan's grandson is in there. Saying, fuck this, this Bob guy is a fraud.
Where is this? Where is this post, Bob? Is it on Facebook?
Oh, okay. No, I'll post it. It's a tweet. Tweet Most column. So okay. Let me find it here.
That's what
Skip
I am.
Saying? Skip says he sends an email, listening now with earplugs. Does that mean... Is she being funny? If she doesn't want to hear what she's what she's listening
no,
to?
No, she has the earbuds to listen, like what JW has.
So the kids don't hear
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
She said, missed most of the show since Skype as internet, not great. We'll try and catch the archives. Love the music session. Okay, so what do I have to look up, Chad? The tweet now. So I look up, there's Mark. Yeah, okay, so there's the link. So I'll post the link. Okay, see if that, just click on that and start reading the content.
So that explains why Ian said that the McLuhans were looking at you.
Did they say that tonight?
Yes, yes.
Whoa. How did he say that?
It was like something in passing.
They were watching me. Well, he would know what I was experiencing with the tweet and that the past 24 hours, but... This guy is the first guy to say this act, to say it accurately. Are you looking at his first tweet?
Yeah, Bob, I'll have to, let me see. I'll have to join Twitter because it won't let me. I just see the first thing. One of the most important people alive is a Canadian man who says he's over 100 years old, claims to be Bob Dobbs and a member of the Illuminati with regular interface with supernatural forces. He was an archivist for Marshall McLuhan's estate and puts out at least 40 hours of content a week. Every week for years.
That's the most accurate statement of somebody commenting on me. That includes all the factors.
Yeah.
All the aspects right there.
Oh, wow. It was yesterday. Okay, it's yesterday. Well, no, Friday.
On McLuhan's birthday, this comes up.
Yeah. Wow.
Is this on Twitter?
Yes.
Can you put the link in the chat if you haven't already?
It is. It is. That's nice. Where I'm reading it from.
Yeah, I put it in there.
Okay, cool. Thank you. Wow.
I love the comment. If you start getting into this, there's no way back, so be careful.
I know. That's why I don't have Twitter.
They warn people.
One of the most important people alive is a Canadian man. Yeah. Oh, there's a YouTube link.
That must be symptomatic of we're both ready for the press conference if fucking nobody is tweeting accurate stuff.
Yeah,
that's how close we're getting. It's
so
good,
right? They have been watching. They have been watching.
Yes. Yeah, and it's your 100th birthday. Yeah, with everyone on Zoom.
Yeah, do you see the link he provides is the footage of the birthday?
Yeah.
The Zoom. That's pretty good. So what's proof that they've been watching? What angle are you taking?
That this tweet is so accurate, such an accurate portrayal of you from a random person out there shows that people are paying close attention to you, like Ion has said.
More and more. More and more. And then he does a follow-up. He's even more accurate. He says this, "I can't overstate how much influence he's had." Despite being completely under the radar. Now, how would he know? He has all these abandoned websites that have extremely rare PDFs on them. He used to upload scans of books that no one has, like Wyndham Lewis's books on Hitler.
Wow.
Books that no one has.
Looks like we have to get this guy on the show.
Yeah. I did. I posted to him. You scroll down. It's not right. It should be right there, but you got to go way down, and you'll see my response. Where is it? I'm going way down. Seeing all this other stuff, I don't think I'm in that guy's tweet or something.
If you go down too far, Bob, don't go down too far.
It says show more replies. Yeah, hit the show more replies. And there's Andrew McLuhan. And, so this guy responds to Andrew's insulting, hitting his head about how stupid is this R. Cam guy. And R. Cam says, hey, man, he's done something no one has ever done. Now, that's fucking incredible. What did I do? But that's an accurate statement, right? He's an artist. Very good statement. Then he repeats, he's the greatest living artist, as he says. So I don't see my thing, Chad. Show more replies. I gotta. There's more under our cam saying he's an artist. So what is that one? Come on, let's hear those. Yeah, so somebody says, is this Bob Dobbs, the same guy who created Church of the Subgenius? And then Cam says, no, he trolled them by saying, I made this up. It's pretty funny. So I don't see my thing, though.
It's there. You just have to keep going.
Have you seen it?
Yeah, it's like the last comment, I think.
So I'm going down. He trolled them. Now, Lyman Lou, your wedding song, that's something else, right? The woman with the turntable. That's someone else. That's not part of I'm going to click on that. It says show more replies. Maybe it is part of his. Yeah, I'm the first guy, and when you click underneath her, I go, thanks for the accurate appraisal of my work, RCAM. You can call in. I give the number. We're on the air right now for the next 6 hours. You can ask Ian a question or make a comment. So then somebody says, real content. You may not like it, but this is what peak performance looks like. That's a good statement.
Wow.
Yeah.
These are all the lurkers. When you unmute everybody, these are the ones that are just hanging there.
Yeah. One guy goes, wow, I thought Bob was a Discordian ruse. Have you read the Dreadlock Recollections by Kerry Thornley? And I just bought a bunch of books by him, by Kerry Thornley. I can DM a PDF. It was awesome. So he's talking about Kerry Thornley, the friend of Lee Harvey Oswald that Jim Garrison forced to testify at the Clay Shaw trial. And then somebody, Doug Spanky, says, oh, hell yes, let's fucking go. We don't know if he's talking about me or Kerry Thornley. Now, I'm being mixed in with Kerry Thornley, a guy who's in the Church of the Subgenius book, writing a column saying Lee Harvey Oswald acting alone killed Kennedy. He's making the case that Lee Harvey Oswald did it himself. Then Jenry says, a cult that claims to worship him, I think this guy thinks it's me, a cult that claims to worship Dobbs called the Church of Jesus left a CD mixtape of home recorded music in a park in my town that I found. Went a little down the rabbit hole on the cult and man. Weird but funny. Well, those are good reviews. So I don't know if he means me. Well, was the mixtape of Stang stuff or the album, you know? Can't tell what the... We can't even tell who they're talking about. That's how the deep cover I have.
There's just so many people here who are kind of hooked in now.
Yeah.
Like, we've paid attention long enough to at least comment on it. You know, like, the guy chatted to the guy three times, can't keep up. He's on a level above everyone.
Yeah. I like this statement. I'm assuming he's talking about me. He says, real content. You may not like it, but this is what peak performance looks like. Now, that's right. 33,000 hours, man. That's peak performance. So I can't – well, maybe I can. I'm going to put in an updated – link to that Gene has to my timeline. So I'll put it in there, and then there's no way to make it go in there unless reply is going to change. So I have to bring that link up. But do you see? I'm going to put it in there, and I'm blinking. Tweet your reply and see if it'll work here. You have to know about Gene's version of my timeline. We had to dump the old one.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you got to hear. I'm going to post it. This is the one that she's always updating. So there it is. And I take that over to his scene. Put in, I'll say, a more up-to-date. Oh, so the reply. Once I post something, reply is no longer dim. Click on it, and it posts it. So good. The guy can even find out more stuff. So I wanted to post my statement about I'm the greatest artist alive today, and I posted it, and it was all purple. And it wouldn't let me click it into it. I said, what the fuck? They're going to approve it or something? And then later I said, oh, yeah, this is Twitter. You can only do 160 fucking letters. And I put about 2,000 letters in my post. But that's a strange statement. I can't overstate how much influence he's had. What the fuck? What's that? What's he basing that on? You'd have to do some serious scanning of all the things I did or who I connected to. You'd have to know about the Zappa interviews. You'd have to know about Croker. You'd have to see all this different stuff and then realize how important that was. Then you could say, oh, this guy, he knew everybody, you know. Then he'd know something. Well, maybe this guy does know something. Okay, I'm only talking about myself by default. You're supposed to be coming up with shit.
AI is the devil.
AI is the devil? Okay, I just posted his link. You should save that link. That goes right to the birthday Zoom. 9 hours long.
Got it.
What?
Got it. And cool. The archives. Yep. The links work.
Yeah.
Well, thanks, Bob. So what, I'm gonna get some sleep. Thank you.
You're welcome.
See you there, everyone. Bye.
Yep. Thanks for your postings.
No problem. I had fun.
So, anybody got anything to say? That was a good Phineas Wake tonight.
Yes.
That Ian did.
Yes.
Pretty amazing how fast Ion speaks about their interpretation. They just keep rolling along, you know?
Mm-hmm. They're never in doubt, that's for sure.
Yeah, they have very good associating resonance. They see a word, they immediately can connect it to Iondom or to events. Really fast. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. What I noticed this session is that there was something I remember putting in the book about that you can control Ion through grammar. But this session, they were really active on the periods in the punctuation.
Yeah.
They wanted you to stop.
Well, that's grammar.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what? They said you could control Ion through grammar?
Yes. Yes.
Hmm.
I'll get the quote. Hold on, I'll look for it. One moment.
Interesting to say grammar, because that's one of the components of the trivium.
Yep. But with McLuhan, it's more about the quadrivium.
Hmm.
It's post-Gutenberg. The quadrivium is music, geometry, arithmetic, and astronomy.
Okay.
So that's really what McLuhan was doing. He was looking at the new astronomy, the new landscapes that had swallowed up the universe. Let me read you what I wrote about myself. It's very important. Listen to this. There's this article that came up on McLuhan's birthday. It was written in the New York Times, October 14, 2000. We had just moved to City Island after being on on East 91st Street for 7 years. We moved in August 2000, and there's an article on McLuhan, hadn't been one.